You know, it might be good to start with a definition, you know, so we have already kind of danced around this, and this is a complicated, you know, conversation about definition and even what it matters, but do we want to try to define it first?
So this is from y'all's article. What texts of everyday writing share in terms of defining features is threefold. They're purposeful, they're self-sponsored, and barring from Jenny Rice, they are inactive.
And you know, okay, so I also, again, Jeff, this is from your work. In Jeff's chapter of in Lifespan Development, where he talks with writers about what they think, you know, a definition of everyday writing is, you used an old definition of this draft. Is that right?
Yeah, so
that was a great definition. I don't know why we departed from that.
Yeah, when I wrote that chapter that's in the Lifespan collection, that was the definition that we had. Going back to the candor point that you made earlier, Joe, I feel like we, the three of us alongside Yancey, we had worked on an article together, and we really labored, like we spent a lot of meetings kind of going back and forth about what our definition is and how that would like include or exclude certain things. And we were trying to be really deliberate about those inclusions and exclusions. And so when I had started this draft for Talon and Ryan's collection, I'm pretty sure that this was the definition that was in our article. I mean, I'm sure I would have copied it, you know, come close to copying and pasting it. I don't think that counts as plagiarism if this comes up later. But I think by the time the book was published, the article had gone through quite a few different instantiations. And so we came up with that shorter one, that Jacob had read.
What was the difference between your definition and the shorter one?
So I'll quote. Starting the quote, in order to specifically highlight mundane writing tasks, I, Jeff, along with Aaron, Joe, and Kathy, defined everyday writing as, quote, the ubiquitous self-sponsored writing typically operating outside the regulation and oversight of an institution or representative of an institution. So we kind of, and I go on in this chapter to kind of say we did that explicitly, as I mentioned before, to like include and exclude certain things. And one of the things we wanted to do was exclude things like the sponsored work, like from Brandt, that kind of like extracurricular, like I'm telling you to do this, that happens at school and work. Cause our goal at the time, at least, especially I think for Aaron, Joe and I, was to, orient discussions towards those unsponsored writing tasks that really hadn't, at least in our mind, gotten the attention that we felt like they should. Because a lot of those discussions in our field go back to the classroom or that kind of extracurricular, maybe not in a classroom, but classroom connected or professional. And so we felt like, you know, there's this really big bulk of writing that happens outside of that. And so our definition was like specifically attuned to that. And then for the SAR piece, we had that shorter, I should have it pulled up.
Well, I had the
three purposeful, inactive, self-sponsored.
Yeah. So it still has elements of that, but I think ours, I feel like the one we ended up with at SAR was, you know, maybe partly to feel more encompassing of the articles that came later, since it was that kind of framing introduction piece. Whereas the one we had before was kind of more of a standalone piece that would maybe we had hoped would be, we had grand dreams it would be the kind of like catalyst that would cause a rupture in the field and, you know, be our like comp-related Martin Luther moment, but it did not go that far.
I think it's hard, right? Because like the three terms almost functions like a meme. So like you get, it's like easy to remember, but Jeff's definition that he read was like so exacting and accurate. And I think the part of institutions is really interesting. And I think like that's the most interesting thing to run with, but it's wild how different they are though.
I do want to say, as much as I would love to take credit for it, and I did put it in print, I definitely could not have come up with that on my own. I think it felt frustrating, but ultimately productive at the time to have, like, we really had a lot of conversations sitting in the rec comp common room going like, you know, if we include this, what does that exclude? Well, does this count? Like, what about, Joe, I remember us having a conversation. You might remember it better, but there was something like, if they're, you know, if two people are working at a job and they pass a sticky note to each other about their work, but it's not, you know, a function of a task, does that count as sponsored or unsponsored? And we really went like minutely into the details of
the
like
two that I remember.
Or
that reminds me of the Underlife scholarship, sort of the note example. Yeah, yeah. That's a good one.
But the two that I remember were, is a quilt everyday writing? Yeah. That was like 3 hours of discussion. Yeah. And another one was, if Barack Obama wrote a note while he was president that would then go in the Library of frickin' Congress or wherever the hell, I don't know how the president, his presidential library, is that everyday writing? And these were hours of discussion. And I don't want us to talk about whether these two examples are, because we've already kind of, and I don't know how useful that was, but it helped us to get to a definition, you know.
It was very useful to me. I think that's a fantastic segue for the thing that I want to say. When I was writing the South Atlantic piece with Yancey, I didn't really want to come to a definition. So I borrowed, I think, the part from Made Not Only in Words, and I borrowed mostly from Hesse's C's address, just to denote that I'm putting this useful name on something that's not school or work. The thing I kept going back and forth with in the draft and then in review and conversation was like this attention to money. Like if money was enabled the act of everyday writing to happen, or if money came as a result of everyday writing, then it didn't count as everyday writing. And Jeff's definition is making me think more sort of about that question. But it's almost like, I guess, to your point about quilt and Barack Obama and post-it note. It's like, it's hard. It's working from specific examples of, you know, I post something online, it accidentally goes viral, and now I'm getting like YouTube creator fund money. Like that's not, but then that's sort of what's reality, I guess. So the inclusion, exclusion thing is interesting, but I could see, you know, losing a year or two playing that game too.
Yeah. Should we continue on that kind of like departures of the definition question?
For sure.
Because I think, Jacob, you know, kind of going over our notes that we all put up before this, that your points about the economic factor were interesting to me. Because at the time when we were coming up with this definition and when I was kind of like firming up the ground that I felt would be or would not be everyday writing, influencer culture, and I think like digital means of kind of capturing and monetizing things, they existed, but they were, you know, I think at the time there was big conversations. It was, you know, like the famous people on Twitter or Instagram would get paid to do a SponCon post, where that feels very sponsored. Like, I mean, it's in the name, sponsored content, but then now it's much easier in a way, or much more proliferated, to have smaller versions of someone making content where they're self-sponsored. You know, it's not sponsored by an institution, but it's their livelihood. And so I wonder in some ways where I don't know exactly where I would fall on that kind of conversation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to your point about like these technologies, these practices, I think scammers and grifters are like really good cases for savvy writers. And I don't, looking at Brandt's definition of sponsorship before this, I was wondering like, how would a scammer's affiliate marketing scheme posing as a self-help Reddit thread map onto like the dimensions of these definitions? Because it feels like the genres of everyday writing, you know? Mm-hmm. But then there's this other part that's like not, I guess, no one could even anticipate. I wouldn't be able to anticipate.
Right. I mean, thinking in the genre conversation, it's like, you know, brands are all over TikTok with their own accounts. So, you know, it's like Wendy's has their, I don't know if they actually, I'm an old guy. I'm not on TikTok, but Wendy's has a TikTok account, or any brand has their TikTok account. They're obviously cribbing the genres made by quote unquote regular people to make their videos. So it's the same genre, but because of its corporate connection, I would say the brand account isn't everyday writing. But if someone's brand is them being an influencer, I would almost say that that is everyday writing in a way, because it's a single person. But then I'm also not, I don't know. I'm not going to put my stake in the ground, but.
See, my issue with conversations about definitions, and and we're kind of getting to this, which is like, why would this matter? Why would it matter whether a TikTok from Wendy's or a TikTok from your neighbor is everyday writing, or like where that line is, right? And I think what Yancey did, when we wrote that definitions piece at the start of the SAR article, Yancey primarily did the introduction material, where she did the kind of definitional work. What she did, what I think made a lot of sense, was she defined everyday writing. I mean, we have that one line, but all the stuff before that, she defines it in relationship to other stuff. And one of the kind of central reasons why we landed on that particular definition was, I mean, there's a lot of things that she talks about how everyday writing is defined in relationship to other things, but one in particular is its relationship to schooling, you know, or to institutional writing. And because we might compare everyday writing as a concept to Anne Ruggles Geer, I believe, her understanding of it as the extracurricular, right? That was a big part of this, is that when we think about writing as extracurricular, it has a, the central component is the curricular, and this is extra to it, right? And so we wanted to define everyday writing as, like, it doesn't necessarily need to have a primary tether to institutional writing. It's, the reason why it's interesting is that it exists on its own. Like, it, you know, of course it has, like, all this stuff is enmeshed with one another, right? And I think Barton and Hamilton in their local literacies book talk about how, like, we thought there would be distinction between home writing and school writing and work writing. There is not that distinction. It's all kind of meshed together. I agree with that. But we wanted to make a definition that was, like, it is something that could be theorized on its own. That this writing doesn't have to be understood through the prism of the curricular, right? So to call it extracurricular tethers that stuff to teaching of writing and school-based writing. To call it everyday writing is to say that it's its own thing. So to me, it's like, that's its value. Its value is really to theorize writing. So to me, that was like the salient point of the definition, is that, like, we're just trying to draw a spotlight. Whether something falls on in it or not may not necessarily be the thing that matters that much. What matters is that, like, we just want to draw attention to this other stuff and begin to ask different kinds of questions. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
I agree. I think that was bigger for me than the, you know, the questions are kind of nuanced discussions of, like, you know, is this tiny thing, would it fall slightly outside the light or would it fit in? The bigger point for me was what you mentioned of, like, let's get away from how does this affect the composition classroom or how is it connected to schooling, and go straight to, this is the writing that happens out here that I think we all felt was too overlooked or not even looked at. Aaron, do you have any departures, like, from that definition that we worked on?
So I don't know that this is quite that, but something that is connected, one of the ways that I sort of got into everyday writing in the class was the notebook that my great grandmother kept. And then I've sort of continued getting pieces from the house, my grandmother's house. And there are years worth of financial records, like, chronologically, like, in a stack. And then in some cases, there's some writing on that. And it's like boxes and boxes in the attic. And this is all relevant because it got me thinking about what an economic analysis of those records might look like. Like, is there a way that we can think about, like, this component of writing through the lifespan? And the shorter answer is the house is going away, and so those things can't be rescued.
I think one other thing, I'm in my notes as I was thinking about this, especially thinking about those three terms that we settled on for the SARP, so purposeful, self-sponsored, and inactive. One thing that I kind of missed from that definition, and I think about a lot in my own thinking about everyday writing, is a term that we had initially borrowed from Teresa Lillis, who's a sociolinguist, where she talked about ubiquitous. Her term wasn't everyday writing, hers was ordinary writing. But she talked about how ordinary writing is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And one thing I really liked about that is she says it's like ubiquitous to the point of invisibility. Like it becomes so overwhelmingly everywhere that we just don't often look at it. And I think, Aaron, your great grandmother's journal is a kind of like good example of that, especially for her. It's like she maybe wouldn't have considered that artifact important because it was such a ubiquitous and like spreading part of her life. Your family might not have considered it important because it was just a thing that they maybe always noticed, or was one document in the midst of many other, you know, artifacts and documents that they put in a box that you uncovered later. And I think that that's really something, excuse me, that we felt was important in trying to highlight this, was all of this writing is so ubiquitous, but in all of our conversations, or not all, but many of our conversations in writing studies, it felt invisible. Like, we're going to not focus on that. We're going to focus on this thing in the classroom. And even when people did focus on everyday writing adjacent materials, it was always, almost always, with that coda at the end of like, here's how you would bring this into the composition classroom, which I think to us in our early conversations was like, why are we shoehorning this into conversations about writing that is totally disconnected from that?
You know what, I think something else that's kind of interesting is when Yancey herself talks about, like in the interview that she did for this collection, when she talks about everyday writing, like she talks about things like tombstones, right? And so then that's, her research is located in like the tombstones that she studied in immigrant Montana or wherever it was.
I was on a trip to Montana, specifically to immigrant Montana, which is where my mother's mother grew up. And my one of my four sisters, in looking at the tombstones, we were walking, you know, walking around looking at the tombstones, and my great-grandparents are buried there, which means I can be buried there, good news. And it just occurred to me that this was absolutely everyday writing. I mean, it was so, so interesting because you got a very, you know, tombstones have a genre to their own, of their own. It's a short form kind of bio. The visuals on the tombstones, especially as they've changed over time, moving from very religious visuals to ones that are much more vernacular. They could be ballet shoes, tennis rackets, golf clubs.
Where I remember, she had presented this research at Florida State. It was kind of like a little faculty, you know, talk, and she had Q&A. And I don't remember who said it. I'll remember this later on. She had asked, I don't think tombstones are, I didn't ask, I think she literally said, I don't think tombstones are everyday writing. How do you justify that?
More of a comment than a question.
Yeah, really. That was really the point. I think she might have asked that as a question. Her point was to say, I really don't think tombstones are everyday writing. And I agree, and I don't think it matters. The point is, when I defined everyday writing in my dissertation, I didn't use the definition we used in our article. I said it was ubiquitous, mundane writing. And the phrase that Yancey uses all the time, that mediates life. And so, like, the mediating of life, that is the thing that I think Yancey cares most about when she talks about everyday writing, when she talks about tombstones, or even when she was talking about stuff in her interview. It's the stuff that mediates a person's life. It's the writing you do to, like, just live your life, you know? And sometimes that writing is going to be, like, institutional writing, but sometimes it's not, right? And that's the stuff that we're kind of interested in things. Like, I always loved your grandmother's stuff, Aaron, because that's writing that she used to mediate her life. Journals that she would write down financial information, right? She was using this writing for herself, you know? And what's fascinating to me about that is that to analyze Bessie's material, to analyze her material, it's the question you ask, And people could ask the question, how does Bessie develop writing over time? That is actually not that interesting of a question. What is a more interesting question is, how did this woman use writing as part of a way to mediate her life? And that is a question that we do not ask that much in this field. We do not ask, what is this writing doing? Why? How did this person use writing? What function does this writing have in this person's life? We ask the question, how do you develop writing? How do you improve your writing? How does the writing process work? And those questions are well and good. What everyday writing gets us to is talking about what writing does in our lives. That's what's interesting about it.
Yeah, I was struck by that piece as well, sort of the way Kathy talks about everyday writing in the interview, and it sort of spurred this realization for me that for much of my life I have very intentionally created spaces where the writing that is connecting me with mostly friends is like visible. So one example, you can see this like ridiculous Christmas light sort of tree thing back there, and there are little tags hanging on it, and those are gift tags from Jamie. And so every year I'm like saving these things and adding them. I have stuff from at least Joe and Jeff, I'm not sure about you, Jacob, like in my office on campus, like postcards and things like that. And I think because family had problematic things for me, being able to just sort of see these pieces of like, there are people who, even if they're not with me right now, are like, I am connected with.
Yeah, and that, I think that's where I really like that enacted piece of like, what does this writing do? Not just that it is, or why was it created? Because, you know, it's like we created the things like, I'm sending Erin a note of congratulations and I'm mailing it to her. It's like, that's more of the process. But the what it does is like, you just mentioned, Erin, of like, it, you know, shows a connection. It shows, you know, whatever. I think that showed up a lot in Kathy's discussion with her grandkids and stuff like that. It's like, she leaves them things to, you know, she kind of like, you know, encourages them through these activities, but the writing that is there isn't really about the process, it's about the thing that the writing does at the end. And to go back to make it about myself again for a moment, to go back to my research, like when I worked with everyday writers, I went in with our definition, and I felt so sure like this definition is important about the, you know, ubiquitous non-sponsored thing separated from school and work. And then I talked to them like, you know, how does a term like everyday writing, how would you define it, and would it matter to you to even have it? And for all of them, that enactive part, and the back to Joe's point of like mediating life, all of their definitions of everyday writing went back to that. Especially for them, it was for communication or network, like keeping a connection with other people, or through organizing their life through like, you know, scheduling things, making journals. So for them, it was all about, you know, not the sphere in which it was done, but the mediating or enactive thing that it ended up doing for them, which I think has kind of changed my thinking about it a bit more. I think because what we mentioned earlier about our interest in everyday writing, I always wanted everyday writing to be the thing that got my attention out of school, because I don't like, ironically, as a professor, I don't like school and I don't like writing for school. And I wanted that to be available for other people. But I think for quote unquote real people, real everyday writers, they don't care about that because they're out of school and they have bad tastes of writing because of their experiences in school often. But then when they think about everyday writing as a concept, it's about, you know, oh, like they weren't paying attention to it because it was ubiquitous. But after we paid attention to it, you know, in our conversations, they were able to say, oh, this writing, like writing is actually valuable because it does these two things for me. And so I think that mediating part, you know, could be a worthwhile inclusion.